Ordinarily, I would explain that picture on the front of your bulletin, but I'm not going to do that till the third point to keep you in suspense. Yeah, you have to stay awake for the entirety of the sermon, so perhaps that will be an inducement to you. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, I think you would agree that there are many kinds of poverty in this world. There's, of course, the poverty of means, where you don't have what you need to survive or to thrive. There's also the poverty of ignorance, where you are shackled in and misunderstanding and stuntedness. There's also the poverty of justice, where you are shackled to structures and cultures that are rife with inequity and inequality and injustice. Those are all kinds of poverty that we're familiar with. And yet I'd like to argue to begin this morning that there's an even deeper kind of poverty. Mother Teresa was once heard to say that the most terrible poverty in this world is that of loneliness, of having the feeling of being unloved. That you may have everything else in this world, but if you do not know the experience of kindness or goodness or acceptance, then you are people most impoverished. We learn love at first if we're fortunate from our parents. We discover what kindness is, and we learn to practice that from what has been modeled for us. And should we marry, we learn a different kind of love. But there is a kind of relationship that is most pervasive throughout the entirety of human existence that even forms the foundation of any physical intimacy that you might have with a spouse that we must all come to reckon with, and that is the relationship called friendship. Friendship is at the heart of all other relationships. And therefore, if it is such a thing to be valued, it is such a thing to be experienced throughout our lives, then it requires a certain amount of wisdom in order to cherish it and to benefit from it. For those of you that are just joining us this week, we have been in a series since the beginning of the year on the book of Proverbs. We have been in search of wisdom. And this day, we're going to give our attention to what the Proverbs have to say about wisdom of and for friendship. And as we look to the Proverbs for that kind of insight, we're going to learn three things about friendship: what defines it, what threatens it, and what sustains it. What defines friendship, what threatens friendship, and what sustains friendship. We're going to be reading throughout the Proverbs. In your bulletin is an insert of all the texts that the sermon is based upon. So would you stand as we read through those passages? Readings from the Proverbs. The ear that listens to life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. Whoever ignores instruction despises himself, but he who listens to reproof gains intelligence. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you. Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda. Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, "I'm only joking." Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel. Do not forsake your friend and your father's friend, and do not go to your brother's house on the day of your calamity. Better is a neighbor who is near than a brother who is far away. Whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice, rising early in the morning, will be counted as cursing. Iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another. Whoever rebukes a man will afterward find more favor than he who flatters with his tongue. A man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Why do we even need to talk about friendship? I dare say if I were to ask you what a definition is, you could probably give me a pretty serviceable one. Why is it then that we need to sort of take friendship and put great focus on it and sort of explode it and try to see it in its most constituent parts? Why is that necessary? Why is this not just an exercise in redundancy? I think the reason for that is because there's this idea called marital enrichment. And it's not as if those that go through marital enrichment don't know what a marriage is or what's supposed to happen in one. It's that they forget, or they refuse to consider, or they realize that they just don't have what it takes to be steadfastly loving. And that's why they need a little guidance, a little wisdom, a little impetus to be able to live as true loving people. I think the same is equally true of anyone who has someone called a friend. Friendship is necessary for us to understand, first of all, in terms of just a simple definition. What do the Proverbs define friendship as? You would agree, because all of you have had this experience, that friendship can arise in innumerable ways, through a common interest, through a common experience, through a common identity, or through a common need. Like C.S. Lewis put it, friendship is born at that moment when one man says to another, "What? You too? I thought I was the only one." That's how friendships start. My friendship, my earnest friendship in kindergarten with a guy named Matthew Rosenthal, started on the first day of class. It began with a need of crayons. He forgot his, and I was willing to share mine. And from there emerged a friendship that lasted decades. Just that simple little need drew us together and bound us together for a long time. And so this world, if you might put it this way, is eminently conducive to the birthing of friendships. But what marks them? What is true of the friendships that last? At least in these passages in the Proverbs, friendship is defined by two characteristics: fidelity and mutual edification. You see that feature of fidelity in what are the two most cited proverbs on the topic of friendship. The first is in Proverbs 17:17, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." What that text is saying is that what characterizes a true friend is an abiding loyalty, a constancy, as one commentator put it. Now, it would seem that that proverb is drawing a comparison between one who is a friend and one who is a blood brother. But as one commentator put it, it's his estimation that there's actually being a contrast that's being argued here. If you read any part of the Old Testament, you will see how central family is, how one's name as an identification of one's kinship mattered in almost every realm of human existence. And so whereas blood kin had a built-in expectation to show up when you're in trouble, what this proverb is saying is that it's a friend who shows up all the time, not just when you're in adversity. Kin shows up because they have to. Friends show up because they want to. And that's what defines a friend. And that's why we would say a friend is of an inestimable value. And that's the same thought that's seconded in Proverbs 18:24. It says, "A man of many companions may come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." Which, you might put it in another way, you can have a lot of acquaintances, but still be left in the lurch. A lot of people can fawn over you, smile at you, show up when you throw a party, but when you're in trouble, crickets. And yet there are true friends whose fidelity will rival that of even family. The most vibrant biblical example of that kind of fidelity is what you find as it's described in the relationship between David and Jonathan in 1 Samuel. In the wake of dispatching Goliath, David is brought before King Saul. King Saul asks him who he is, what family he's from. David discloses that he's the son of Jesse in 1 Samuel 19. And in the wake of that, it says this: "As soon as David had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let David return to his father's house. And then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. In that moment, Jonathan feels an immediate connection and appreciation for David such that he gives to David what is most costly to him. And if you know the full story of their friendship, you know that it is Jonathan's friendship with David that leads him to thwart the maniacal designs of Jonathan's own father. When Saul is out to kill David, Jonathan, if you will, defies his father's intentions and for friendship with David, seeks his rescue and his protection. That's fidelity. That's fidelity of a costly sort. To switch gears a little bit, Peter Jackson, the filmmaker of all of the Hobbit movies and the epic trilogy of The Lord of the Rings, has been much maligned, you might say, for his alleged cinematic mistreatment of the Tolkien classic, and for good reason. But I think, did I say that? I'm sorry, did I say that out loud? I think any detractors of whatever he did would probably agree that there is one thing he got right. What he got right was the portrayal of the friendship between Frodo and Sam. They endure so much together. They demonstrate undying loyalty to one another, frequently in the face of death. They even experience a period of estrangement between them from which they must recover and then be reconciled. And in the end of that epic, their friendship is as much the glory of the story as the fulfillment of their quest. And you feel that. And I was drawn to weep over that. Both David and Jonathan and Frodo and Sam will illustrate that feature of fidelity that is true of every abiding friendship. But they also demonstrate one other feature of friendship, if you're going to define it, and that is of mutual edification, which is just a highfalutin of saying having a shared interest in one another's good. In Proverbs 27:17, it's another famous text. It says, "Iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another." I have a friend who works with leather and with wood and with metal, and he came to me one day and he said, "How does that work? Because you don't just put any two pieces of iron together. They don't really sharpen each other. So what is that text getting at?" It's the image there is not of just any two pieces of iron. The image is that of an iron sword or a blade that is being honed by a sharpening iron. Both made of the same substance, but both forged for different purposes. And so in this image, it's the edge of the sword that is meeting the surface of the tool and is being sharpened by their interaction. The text speaks of men. It's equally applicable to women. And therefore, what it's envisioning is a concerted and persistent effort to bring out the fullness of the other, to nurture the usefulness of the other. And though I may be guilty of trying to squeeze just a little bit too much out of the proverb than what's there, while this proverb implies a reciprocal, mutual interest in edification, at times, if you want to press the image even more, at times, one is the sharpener and the other one is the one who's being sharpened. And at other times, the role is switched. It's the nature of friendship. One is inconvenienced for the good of the other. And vice versa. Now, all that's vivid, but all that's abstract, right? What really is in the mind of the Proverbs when it's talking about friendship and how that entails a faithful interest in one another's good? The Proverbs give us two expressions of that sharpening. The first is an offering guidance. When you look at Proverbs 27:9, it says just as vividly, "Oil and perfume make the heart glad, and the sweetness of a friend comes from his earnest counsel." In a world like that, you have to be transported to really appreciate what that vivid image is getting at. In a world where dust and refuse were everywhere, which would cake on the feet and on the skin and cause everything to stink, you would never underestimate the refreshment that would come from rubbing olive oil on the skin. or in spritzing your clothing with incense. That mattered. It was a small thing, but it was a huge thing, and it was deeply satisfying to anybody that experienced it. And it's that kind of refreshment, that kind of satisfaction that is being likened to receiving wise counsel from someone who is a trusted friend. The imagery there may be ancient, maybe even a little bit inaccessible, but the sense is eminently clear and modern. Because you've been in moments when you're stuck, when you're stymied, when you're sorrowful, when you're saddened, and it was the insight of a friend who had a perspective that you never would have come up with, that you never would have seen, and it was like a tall glass of tea on a hot day when they said, "Have you ever considered this?" You were transformed by their simple sharing of wisdom. But unless they had taken the time and the interest to understand your condition and assess that condition and then bring their own wisdom to bear on helping you, if you would not have had that kind of investment from them, you would have been at sea, adrift in your moment. It's the essence of friendship to work in that way. It's really the essence of faithful presence unto one another. The sharpening of friendship is expressed, first of all, through guidance. But it happens in another form, too. One that in some ways will actually test the mettle of that friendship. Look up at the verse 2 texts on your insert there from Proverbs 15. The ear that listens to life-giving reproof will dwell among the wise. Whoever ignores instruction despises himself, but he who listens to reproof gains intelligence. And then look down at Proverbs 27. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Faithful are the words of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy. What those texts are saying is that gaining wisdom depends on a certain receptivity. A receptivity to constructive criticism. It's only by being humble enough to hear feedback, even words that might feel a little sharp at the time. It's only by having that receptivity that you can ever grow into fullness. But those two texts are also saying that it's our friends that have both a mandate to and a suitability for constructively confronting us when we're wrong. That's their job. But that's their greatness. Any sycophant can flatter you with affirmations because they do so only with interest in themselves. But it is a friend who will tell you truths even when it's a hard truth, even when it's a truth that you don't want to hear, even when it's a truth that they might despise you for saying. Like I mentioned in Q&A last week, in the Boy Scout manual, the instruction that they give to people that are trying to save drowning victims is to recognize that more often than not, somebody who is drowning will actually begin to thrash so violently that they will impede your ability to save them. And so it's according to the Boy Scout manual that you must be prepared to smack them if you're going to save them. To save them, you have to thump them. Friends do that for one another, and sometimes they have to do that for one another. Paul has to do that for Peter when Peter is letting himself be influenced by the Judaizers of that time and therefore refusing to eat with Gentiles. And I promise this is my last Tolkien illustration for the sermon. But Bilbo has to do that for Thorin when the latter is becoming consumed with his interest in gold under the mountain, such that Bilbo has to say to him, "Thorin, you are changed." That's what friends do. That's what love does. Now, culturally speaking, there's a certain ambivalence about this aspect of friendship because there's a meme that has risen to meme status. Meming. A meme is a phrase that has just sort of taken hold in our cultural landscape. And that phrase is, "Hey man, don't judge me." In other words, back off. Who are you to dispute my way? Now, if you want to deconstruct that line of thought, if somebody's reproof to you has no basis in fact, then they're right. That's not legitimate. There's nothing to listen to. Move along. And if one is reproving you who's being a hypocrite for doing so, their credibility might be in question, but it still may not change the legitimacy of their charge. But if you take as an abiding principle, hey man, don't judge me, you can't live like that. To deny that anybody else has any insight or a right to offer correction is to assume too much insight into your own way. We said on the very first week of this Proverbs series, why we need wisdom is given the limitations of our understanding and our capacity for self-deceit. So if you live under the rubric, under the meme, hey man, don't judge me, you're a fool. You don't even understand your own limitations. You are living by a hegemony of the self, and in doing so, you are inviting to disaster. Okay, so my definition of friendship is a little heavy thus far, and you might be thinking, wow, where's the fun in that? Who would ever want to be a friend? Don't friends just hang out sometimes? Don't they enjoy each other's company and do fun things? Of course. Friends laugh together, they eat together, they watch film together, they play sports together, they do all sorts of things together. But brothers and sisters, I think you would agree that the depth of a friendship will always correlate not with how many vacations you took together, but with your shared interest in one another's well-being. And that's why we are always running the risk of cultivating, at best, superficial friendships. Is anyone that deep for you? Have you ever invited somebody to do that for you? Or are they ever terrified of ever venturing to say with you a word that you may not find very popular or comfortable in the moment? As one poet put it, it takes a long time to grow an old friend. Growing an old friend requires fidelity and shared interest in one another's good, both in the giving of counsel and in the sharing of hard truth. That's a definition of friendship that the Proverbs gives us. Who wouldn't want that? Who doesn't want somebody like that to count on, right? Friendship is inherently desirable because it's inherently beneficial to everybody who is a friend to one another. So given that it's good inherently and without a case even need to be made for it, why do friendships fail so often? What is that fly in the ointment? The reason friendships fail is because friendships are often unaware of what can threaten them. And the Proverbs are very good about unpacking what can threaten a friendship. So let's look there. Look at Proverbs 25:20. Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes off a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda. Now, that's sort of an odd combination of images. I'm not sure what he was thinking at the time he put that phrase together. The hissing sound, you know it when you pour vinegar on sodium bicarbonate, right? There's this hissing sound. And it's almost like an irritating sound if you get too close to it, which is similar to the idea of the bracing feeling you get that if you're sitting outside in the parking lot on a cold day and somebody grabs your jacket and runs, you shiver. It's uncomfortable. You don't like it. You want to change it as quickly as possible. It's what you feel when someone's trying to inappropriately lighten up a moment that is otherwise sorrowful. They're out of step, they're off point, they're off key, and it grates you. Even friends can totally misunderstand your moment or misunderstand you such that they practically give offense. And so what threatens friendship is, first of all, a thoughtless insensitivity. We are all prone to it, and we can compromise our friendships by it. Look at 27:14. Whoever blesses his neighbor with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing. This immediately translates to you. You get it, especially if you're not a morning person and somebody decides to turn the television on very loud in the morning or scream and run and put on their roller skates and make very loud noises on wood floors. Not that I'm bitter. No. Never had that problem. Few people like to be awoken with the enthusiasm of midday. Right? So the Proverbs are chiding an overbearing demeanor that, again, misunderstands the moment and the person. We talked about Job last week in Q&A, and in my Bible reading it this far into the Old Testament, I'm in the book of Job, and in Job chapter 2, Job's friends start out exquisitely. They come to him in his affliction. They tear their clothes in anguish. They weep with him who is weeping. They sit and are silent with him, just to be with him, just to help him know they are there. They start well, but then they get uneasy about the silence and they feel like they got to fill it with theory. And then they decided to fill it with words that have a kind of truth to them, but a truth that does not fit the moment. They start well and finish horribly. Brothers and sisters, that can happen. That can happen 15, 20, 30 years into a friendship. Now, single instances of insensitivity and aloofness toward the full truth of a moment, those are easily forgiven. But years of thoughtlessness add up. And the relational obtuseness will compromise the friendship. Thoughtless insensitivity threatens it. The second thing that threatens friendship is this: short-sighted self-protectiveness. What do I mean? Look at the last two proverbs on your insight, on your insert. Whoever rebukes a man will afterward find more favor than he who flatters with his tongue. A man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. In the first point, we talked about how friendship is defined by interest in one another's good that often entails confrontation. Without that confrontation, you are inviting your friend to continue on a doomed trajectory. Rather than confront, this proverb envisions one who flatters. Why would he or she do that? Why would they flatter rather than rebuke? It's fear, right? It's fear of offending. It's fear of potentially losing the love of that friend. But what's underneath that fear? I would argue it's the love of your own self. It's the love of self that wants to avoid the potential pain of conflict. But to let that love of self drive that fear of confrontation is only to see as far as the tip of your nose. You may avoid whatever short-term pain now, but you are multiplying it later, both for them and for you. In 29:5, there's a certain ambiguity in the verse when it says that the man who flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet. We're not sure whose feet the net is being spread for with the flattery, whether it's the one who's being flattered or the one who's flattering. But I think that ambiguity might be purposeful. If I'm in league with someone, if I'm a friend to them, if our lives are bound together in friendship and I refuse to say what's necessary for fear of their rejection, then should they fail, I fail too. There's fallout and it comes back unto me as much as unto them. And so self-protection not only exposes the friend to risk that they might have been saved from, it also compromises the friendship. There's one third last thing that compromises a friendship that threatens it. And it's a long phrase, but I think it's right. It's this idea of idolatrous imposition. In Proverbs 25:17, it says, "Let your foot be seldom in your neighbor's house, lest he have his fill of you and hate you." Now, the word there for neighbor is the Hebrew word reach. It's the same word used elsewhere in the Proverbs for the word friend, which makes sense, since to be a friend is in some ways to be neighborly to them. In Leviticus 19, when it says, "Love your neighbor as yourself," the word there is reach. So it's applicable to our friendships as well as to those that we're not as intimately acquainted with. But what this passage is getting at in Proverbs 25 is that you can put an undue burden on the friendship until it actually starts to lose its joy. My wife likes to make fun of Southern hospitality because she's from there. Southern hospitality is defined by this. It is smiling at guests while saying, "Y'all stay as long as you want." And then as soon as they leave, you say, "Gosh, I thought they'd never leave." Southern hospitality. Now, that's a cute idea. But this passage is talking about the limits of what our friendships are to be, or at least how we're to think of them in the grand scheme of our life in God. St. Augustine, in his book on Christian doctrine, wrote of the difference between loving someone for their own sake and loving them for God's sake. Listen to this quote, and don't worry, I'll explain what he gets to. He says, "For we are commanded to love one another, but it is a question whether man is to be loved by man for his own sake or for the sake of something else. If it is for his own sake, we enjoy him. If it is for the sake of something else, we use him. It seems to me that he is to be loved for the sake of something else. For if a thing is to be loved for its own sake, then in the enjoyment of it consists a happy life, the hope of which at least, if not yet the reality, is our comfort in the present time. But a curse is pronounced on him who places his hope in man. Long quote. What's he referring to? Jeremiah 17 says, "Cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength." What St. Augustine is getting at is a warning about making anything, including our deepest friendships, as a substitute for your happiness in God. Now, friends may accentuate that happiness in God. Friends may even confirm to you the goodness of God and the love of God. To be sure, it's not an either-or thing. But friendships can never be a substitute for him. To linger long in a neighbor's house is a metaphor for making him your ultimate home. And the more you try to make a friend your ultimate home, the more you, in fact, drive them away. All of that can serve to diminish and threaten a friendship. So what in the world will sustain it, given how all manner of things can threaten it? Last point. What's going to sustain a friendship? Friendship is a status of sorts, right? It's a declaration of mutual respect and appreciation. But friendship is also an effort. It's an exertion of energy. And that which requires energy also requires resources to supply that energy. Some of that energy comes from within the friendship itself. The nature of friendship is in part the hope of its sustenance. The fidelity, the shared interest in building one another up is serving to preserve the friendship. Makes totally logical, deductive sense. But on the front of your bulletin is that weird picture from the 17th century. Do you know what that is? That is the first effort by any engineer to create something called the perpetual motion machine. Right? Physicists for centuries, engineers for centuries, have been trying to create some sort of mechanism that once you started it getting to go, it would stay going without having to insert new energy into the system. And so that little contraption from 1611 was the very first effort. And physicists have gotten really close. They've created contraptions, like was on the backstory this week, that would go for years, but would eventually slow down. It couldn't sustain the energy it needed to continue. Why have I brought that into a sermon on friendship? Guess. Just as in physics, there is no such thing as a perpetual motion machine, so in friendship, there is no such thing as a relationship that can endure simply from the resources inherent to it. Something's got to come from the outside so that the friendship can be sustained within it. And especially because those within the friendship can do quite a bit to sour, sully, and siphon away the energy for friendship. So then, therefore, what is that resource all friendships would do well to tap into to sustain it? Guess what I'm going to say, right? Derek Kidner says, "The integrity of a friendship depends as much on spiritual resources as does that of an individual." So what is that spiritual resource? The one who was God, but who called those whom he loved friends. "Greater love hath no man than this, than he who laid down his life for his friends, not his subjects." "Faithful are the wounds of a friend, profuse are the kisses of an enemy," is what we heard in Proverbs 27. Brothers and sisters, Jesus was the most faithful of them all in wounding us with the truth about ourselves. He was the most honest, and he did not flinch from saying so. Jesus was the most faithful actually in taking the wounds that were due to us. And he was the most faithful in receiving the kisses of an enemy in order that he might die for the enemies that he would make his friends. We need his friendship. We need his version of friendship to protect and nurture our other friendships. We need his friendship to ward off that which threatens our friendships. Why? How does trust in the gospel of Jesus Christ, do that for us? Brothers and sisters, it's his irrevocable friendship with us that cures us of the fear of rejection that might keep us from speaking hard truths to one another. If they are our God, then we will say nothing to besmirch that. But if God is our God, we will love that friend and say anything that even if it might offend them, if it's still for their good. It's Jesus' unbreakable friendship with us that keeps us from being bewitched by our friends so that we don't end up turning them into substitutes for God. That's why we need that friend. We need that friend, the one who is friend of sinners. The Proverbs gives us a template for friendship. But Jesus gives us himself as a model for friendship, but also as a motive for being a true friend. Greater love hath no man than this, than he who lays down his life for his friends. If you don't have friends like the ones that are described here, pray. Look for friends, maybe even in this room. Some of my closest friends came to me one day and said, I would like to proffer friendship with you. How risky, how terrifying that might be to be vulnerable. The glory of friendship that these texts point to heighten the value of finding, having, and nurturing the friendships that you have like that, or that might, you might find like that. But if you do have friends like that, it is worth asking yourself, is this the model of friendship that you're aspiring to, or have you taken it for granted? Have you given up on this model a long time ago? And it's at that point that you have to ask yourself, would your trust in the gospel might shore up and nurture and reconcile those friendships? And then whether you are with or without such friends, you have to know that you have a friend that will endure and that who experienced the height of poverty that we might become rich, and in doing so made clear that he is in fact a friend of sinners. Amen.